This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we remind you that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom. Every week we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want our veterans to know that we appreciate them for their service and sacrifice. We want their stories to be preserved so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're inspired. Maybe we laugh a little, too. And I think we might get a few chuckles today with Al Flores, because he has the tough memories, but the good memories from World War II. 93 years old. Now, you grew up, you were born in New Mexico. How old were you when you moved to Fresno, California?
Two.
Now, I bring that up because I know that you got into the service before the war in the National Guard. You know what happened to all the guys from New Mexico who got in the National Guard before the war started?
Yes, I had. They were taken prisoners at Bataan. In fact, a good friend of mine, I was in Bataan, and he was had been transported from Bataan. They made him walk.
Yeah, all those National Guard troops from New Mexico, the bulk of them, were taken there, and there were more soldiers from New Mexico on the Bataan Death March than any other state. And there's a great memorial there in Las Cruces to that. So I guess it's a good thing that your family moved from New Mexico to California, huh?
I guess, yes.
What was life like growing up in Fresno as the oldest of 13 children? I want people to hear that. 13 children. Was that a big job to be the big brother to 12 others?
Well, since my dad was a railroad employee, Southern Pacific, they always furnished housing for their personnel. I remember I grew up in this section. It's on G Street on the west side, and they had a big 12-foot wood fence that isolated us from the rest of the world.
And I'm sure that Fresno was a much different place then than it is now. What do you remember about those times fondly? What were the good things about Fresno in the 30s?
You can always hear the clank, clank, clang of the streetcars they used to have, and they finally got rid of those.
Tell me about getting through with high school and what was going on in the world at that time. She graduated from Fresno Tech in 1939, and things were starting to happen in other parts of the world, not necessarily America just yet.
No, at this time, Hitler was doing his act, and I was an avid reader of the Fresno Bee. I always followed up all the things. And then when he tied up with Mussolini, that's what I knew. And they had England on her knees by then. Churchill made a speech I'll never forget. He said, "Never will so many owe so much to such few." He was talking about the Royal Air Force. They were outnumbered by the Germans 10-1, but they went out and met them every time. Yeah, and I'll never forget that speech as long as I live.
So you're reading about this war that's going on half a world away, but you have the feeling we're not going to be able to avoid this?
No, it's not when Mussolini tied up with him. As it turned out to be a fact.
Yeah, you saw it coming. And so what'd you do about it? You decided to sign up?
Yes, I heard about the National Guards, and we trained once a month. And I could see the situation in Europe getting so serious that I couldn't understand why the governments of the United States didn't step in sooner than when they did. So I went ahead and joined the National Guards. I wanted to get some experience. At least I wasn't going to go in there cold feet. I knew what to expect.
So what about the other guys in uniform? How did they treat you? Did you make some friendships pretty quickly, or was that tough?
Well, being Mexican, it took a while for them to accept me. And once they accepted me, well, then I progressed pretty good. I got promoted twice. I was three times in 1 month, but the rules are you can only get promoted twice. No, after they got to know me, I did. Did real well, yeah.
And I know you're not looking for anyone to feel sorry for you. You're not trying to tell a sob story here, but you said that after they got used to, were there some times where you felt that, you know, they were picking on you or discriminating against you because of your heritage?
Yes, I did. Yes, I really did. And so what I did for that, we was in formation, and there was promotions being made. And I knew that I was more qualified than they were. So I challenged to give tests. So they did. But they never showed the results, and yet I could see what was going on. So I went to my first sergeant, and I told his name was Sam. He wound up the sheriff's office also. And I told him, I said, why don't you post the results of the test? Because there was people there. They got promoted. They were strong, and they were rough. And invariably, Al, what do you think we ought to do? See. And I remember this the medical officer's name was Gidley. He had this information, and he brought this deal about there's been some concern about the results of the examination not being posted, what have you. God, pretty soon, my name come up. I made PFC, and before the month was up, they made me a corporal, and then they were going to make me a sergeant. But they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. They can't run three promotions in 1 month. And then from then on in, things worked out. I became in the sheriff's office, and I went from a plain deputy into senior criminologist. I was in charge of the criminal, the investigation part.
Back in those early days of the service, you said it took them a while to get used to you being Mexican. Were there any other Mexican-American or Latino soldiers?
Oh, yes. You'd think it was a Mexican army.
What was the most challenging aspect of your training, the toughest thing to pass or to get through or to deal with?
I know there were some trying times, but I'll tell you, when they needed my attention, I gave it all I had. And my doctor that I worked with, he had a lot of confidence in me.
And how was it that you got on that path? Because I'm sure it wasn't something when you signed up, you checked a box and said, this is what I want to do. At some point, they decided that for you, I'm sure. How did that happen that you ended up as a medical technician?
My mom, when I was a little boy, I used to hear my mom complain about her chest, and found out it was her heart. So I wanted to become a heart specialist. I was able to dissect one heart, because I wanted to see the chambers and the valves and all that. In the service, I never got a chance to do that. They gave me a little mannequin that I could take apart. You know, and all because of my mom. I wanted to become a specialist in the heart, you know, or become pretty proficient because of my mother. That's when I was a little baby. Yeah.
But in the service, they've got you all in there together, and this is an infantry outfit, so guys are going to be assigned to the front lines, or they'll be doing something else. How did you end up with that assignment as a medical technician?
What happened was you always have commission officers running. Each company has a medical unit assigned to them. That unit is also overseen by commissioned officers. Evidently, they saw how involved I was and everything. That they gave me a chance to really get involved in when somebody was hurt and what have you. Evidently, I must have been doing pretty good because they had a lot of faith in me.
Tell me about December 7th. I like to ask every veteran because every veteran has a memory of the day that Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. Where were you and how'd you find out?
I was already in the service. We had just come back from Washington for a month's training.
That's Washington State, Fort Lewis, not Washington, D.C., yeah?
Fort Lewis, yeah. Uh-huh. I used to come home every weekend because I was a non-com. And then I had two fellows from New York. They said to me, the reason why you go home every weekend is because you can't score here. He says, because I only had two buses with 60 or 70 women in it for 1,000 soldiers, you know. And he says, you can't score. So on December the 6th, I stayed, and I went to the dance. And no time at all. Boy, I'm doing my thing out in the thing. And so in the morning, it was Sunday morning, and I was the tent captain. The guys, come on, Al, let's go to the field. I said, no, I'm tired. And the first one, here they come, and I had the radio. I said, being tent captain, you turn the lights off, you turn them on, and right. On radio. And they come, and they woke me up. Wake up. And he said, what's the best? We're at war. And so, what do you mean we're at war? He says, who are we at war with? The Japanese? Oh, really? I didn't even know who they were. He says, turn on the radio. So I turned the radio on, and boy, that's all you could hear, especially the attack on Pearl Harbor. Oh, by the nightfall, we had moved from San Luis Obispo. We were in the hills down in Lower California. We were so poorly equipped and everything. Our biggest gun was a 75-millimeter anti-tank gun.
What did that mean to you? Did that impact you on an emotional level here? You'd been focused on what's happening around the world. You had a sense war was coming, but now that America had been attacked, what did that do to you?
Well, there was so much going on that personal opinions, I don't recall really getting excited about it one way or the other. The only thing that I was concerned about was that how poorly equipped we were. Our rifles, they were using World War I, single action, no magazines or nothing like that, single action, bolt action. This is a Springfield rifle.
Well, yeah, you may have been poorly equipped. World War I helmets, too. I've seen the pictures. But you guys sure did spring into action. Within 24 hours of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the 40th Division had left San Luis Obispo and fanned out all over Southern California. They even employed Greyhound buses with CHP escorts. The threat of a Japanese attack on the California coast had troops from your regiment on Catalina Island in Santa Monica, Ventura. What were you thinking, Al? It sounds so surreal.
I couldn't understand why a young guy like myself was so concerned about the world situation as it stood at that time, when we were given a lot of experience by the world leaders in Europe, mm-hmm. mainly Hitler, mm-hmm. and then Mussolini joined him. England was, they were getting knocked all over, and then that speech that Churchill made, I'll always remember that.
What about the speech that Roosevelt made? Did you hear that on December 8th?
When they hit Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt, you know, he had a distinct voice in his and what he made that speech about what had happened. I was so proud of him that someone finally got attention of what was going on and all that. And he said a few things, and I used to know them vividly. He made a wonderful speech. I really thought a lot of it. He died while I was overseas. Just before Roosevelt died, I was overseas. There was rumors that I was coming home. But that's how the Sergeant Major Halleck comes to me, says, okay, I'll sign this thing. And I looked at it. I says, what is this? He says, don't you want to become a gentleman? I says, well, let me go talk to my captain. So I went to my captain, and he says, I already know about it, Al. They've already approached me. They're going to commission me. He says, don't take it, because we're going to be, I'll tell you before you leave why I'm telling you this. And when got ready to leave, I went to say goodbye to him. He says, I'm going to tell you why. He says, we're having an engagement with the near future, and they estimate the casualty rate to be in around 98%. Which is pretty high, but he didn't give me too much info at that time. Yeah. And when I did leave, he did call me and he told me in Japan they had wharves sticking out, and everybody thought that people went out there to relieve themselves. What they had machine gun units in each one of those things. So you can imagine us coming off the landing boats and those guys with machine guns. They 98% wouldn't have made it. But my captain, he said, no, Al, you go home. You've already done your share, if not more, than a lot of people. So then when I get home, I'll send for you. Because he says, you have the equivalent of a 2-year pre-med student in the States right now. So thank you. Thank you very much, he says. But be sure and get a year's college. So I came home and went to night school for a couple of months to get adjusted. Then I went to City College and got my diploma from them, Associate of Science.
Yes, and you would go on to a long career in law enforcement, a criminologist with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department. But those post-war plans with your captain never materialized. We're going to explore that when we come back. And as far as that warning to get out when he could, that high casualty rate the doctor mentioned for the impending invasion of Japan, we know now that Al's division, the 40th Infantry Division, was to have been part of the spearhead for Operation Olympic, the first stage of that planned invasion. Mr. Flores is thankful he didn't have to experience that, but he did have some very close calls in combat, and we'll talk about them when Hometown Heroes continues after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real a sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.